It's time for episode 27 of the Vatican Centuries. While last week we got a taste of light and shadow as the first of the Renaissance popes, Sixtus IV, built the Sistine Chapel, leaving his mark on Rome, while a fanatic friar by the name of Savonarola is executed, today we move on to more papal splendour, as Botticelli paints the Sistine Chapel, as Alexander VI has the ceiling of the Basilica of St. Mary Major gilded with plundered gold. But do stay tuned and listen to this programme, written and presented by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett.
The Renaissance was nearing its peak. As scholarship and humanism continued to thrive, the complete man reigned supreme. And in this ideal climate, artistic genius reached a perfection never known before or since.
The Age of Discovery had barely begun. In 1496, John Cabot became the first European to cross the Atlantic by the route of the ancient Vikings.
At the turn of the century, Amerigo Vespucci realized that Columbus had discovered a continent, and the German cartographer Waldseer Müller declared that the New World should be named America because Amerigo had discovered it.
In architecture, the ornate pointed arch and soaring Gothic spire had long given way to the simplicity of the classical style.
Houses were no longer fortresses. With larger rooms and windows, the interiors were full of light and colour.
Fireplaces were not only used for cooking, but for heating the houses.
People's table manners were improving. Forks were being used instead of fingers.
Buttons and spectacles were now common.
Simple piety received a new impulse by the Dominican popularization of the rosary.
And on the walls of many churches, the stations of the cross could now be seen.
Rome, at the start of the 16th century, presented a contrasting picture. The splendours of the papal court were offset by the squalor of the city's back streets. Assassins lurking in the shadows rubbed shoulders with brethren of the religious confraternities who provided pensions for widows and dowries for orphaned girls.
Condemned men on their way to the scaffold were accompanied by members of the Misericordia in black robes and hoods and were buried to the chant of solemn prayers.
In many parts of the city, cattle were pastured, and to foreigners, the Romans themselves looked like cowherds, dressed as they were in peasants' cloaks and boots. For them, social gatherings were limited to meetings at church, where they could admire the fine ladies. And at carnival time, when the popes offered them entertainment, magnificent processions celebrating the triumphs of the Roman emperors of old.
But the Romans were only spectators. They took no more part in the events of their time than the pilgrims and other visitors, who are now a permanent feature of the life of the Eternal City. And life there was, in great variety. Rome was distinguished by the elaborate ceremonial of the papal court, partly Byzantine in origin. Rome was the chief school of diplomatic etiquette, a clearinghouse for news, and a vital link in the chain of European politics.
The popes, like other European rulers, were committed to building up a well-financed, efficient, and firmly controlled state. But their office was elective. Unlike other temporal princes, the Pope could not pass on his title to a member of his family. Nor did any Pope ever presume to do so, even when the moral tone of the papacy was at its lowest ebb.
Alexander VI, the Borgia Pope, perhaps painted blacker than he actually was, reigned from 1492 to 1503. In Rome, he was told, there had been more than 220 murders in the 3 months between the onset of his predecessor's illness and his own coronation. This was such a grand affair that Alexander fainted twice during the ceremony.
Alexander's time saw the erection of the famous Tempietto by Bramante, later to have a great influence on Roman architecture. Alexander added a fountain to St. Peter's, called in Pinturicchio to paint the Borgia apartments, and, tradition says, gilded the ceiling of St. Mary Major with the first of the plunder to arrive from the Americas.
Alexander's pontificate was stormy. In 1494, he was obliged to receive Charles VIII of France into Rome. A year later, the Tiber overflowed. Water ran 10 feet deep in the streets and people had to go about in boats. Lightning struck Castel Sant'Angelo, and the gunpowder stored there exploded and destroyed the upper part of the fortress.
A known libertine who openly acknowledged his numerous illegitimate children, Alexander had to face the scathing criticism of the Dominican friar Savonarola, whom he excommunicated and later had executed.
On the evening of November the 2nd, 1499, two men were talking together, Doffo Spini and Sandro Botticelli. Spini was one of the men who had examined Savonarola, sent to his death the previous year. Botticelli had been one of the friar's devoted followers and had given up painting nudes when the Dominican denounced such works. Savonarola had confessed under torture to all kinds of enormities, including fraud and deception. Botticelli suffered deeply from this confession and his hero's subsequent trial and death, and tried desperately to understand the meaning of the tragedy.
According to Doffo Spini, Savonarola's inquisitors had found no sin in him, and the friar had been sentenced to death to appease the Florentine mob.
After Savonarola's execution, Botticelli undertook no more important commissions, and prematurely old, hobbled about Florence on sticks. He had no money, and his powers were failing.
Posterity remembers him very differently. Born in Florence in 1444, youngest of a tanner's 7 children, Botticelli was apprenticed to a goldsmith and later to Fra Filippo Lippi, the painter. He became famous in his lifetime, but although he earned well, he spent freely and was often hard up.
Of a deeply religious turn of mind, Botticelli achieved his first success with a painting called The Adoration of the Magi. It was after this that Sixtus IV summoned him to Rome to take charge of the decoration of the Sistine Chapel.
Back in Florence, Botticelli came into contact with Lorenzo de' Medici's circle and turned to classical subjects. Two of these, The Birth of Venus and The Primavera, are perhaps his greatest loved paintings.
Sandro Botticelli believed that love purified could lead men to truth, and his Birth of Venus illustrated the ideal of Florentine civilization, the setting of what was best in the classical world within a Christian framework.
The art of Botticelli was one with his personality, typical of the early Renaissance, with its hope and belief in the human spirit. It was to give way later to the more sombre, battling art of Michelangelo.